Interview with John Sterk, July 14th, 2006, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, thank you for coming to talk to me. I appreciate it. I want to begin with a little bit of background.
Okay.
Briefly on how you got to the SEC and some of your experiences coming there.
Okay. Well, in terms of how I got there, like most people, it was by accident. I had started my career in government service, and after clerking for a year, was an assistant U.S. attorney here in the District of Columbia from 1976 until either the end of either 1980 or 81, I guess, 80, and I can't remember which. And I went to a small law firm here in Washington. Didn't like the experience, so I was I think it was a combination of the mix of people I was working with and the mix of cases that I had. So I was interested in something that was more challenging. And a friend of mine who was at the U.S. Attorney's Office with me, my supervisor there, Alexia Morrison, was the Chief Litigation Counsel for the Commission's Division of Enforcement. And I heard through a mutual friend that she was looking for people. So I contacted her, spoke with her and John Fetters, and they offered me a job in the trial unit of the Enforcement Division, which is where I spent my first 2 years.
What was the function of the trial
unit? Well, the trial unit then, and I think it still is today, is to be the litigation specialists who take a case once it's been determined that A, it's been authorized, and B, it has not settled, and go to court and try to win. That's functionally what it does. So it's sort of, for want of a better term, they're the barristers of the Enforcement Division.
Did you qualify for that because of your experience in the U.S.?
Yeah. I mean, commission at the time, and I think it's still true today, one of the lawyers in the investigative units either did not have experience going to court or did not have a lot. And so the trial unit tended to be composed of either more experienced lawyers who'd been at the agency for some time or people who'd come from the outside who had been to court quite a bit. And one nice thing about being an assistant U.S. attorney is you go to court a lot, so it was something that I was used to and other folks weren't necessarily.
Did you handle any of the insider trading cases?
Well, that's what I was doing, really, when I got there. There were a series of insider trading cases which arose out of a merger between a company called Santa Fe International, which was an oil drilling company in California, that was acquired by Kuwait Petroleum Corporation, I believe government-owned enterprise in Kuwait. And there were a significant number of options purchases, call options in advance of the merger. Those were investigated before I got to the commission. Emergency relief was obtained in a couple of them. And then I took them over, and there were four or five of those cases. But I got involved sort of in the litigation phase of them.
Did Robert Romano?
Yes.
Was he the one you took things over?
Over time, yes.
Was he in the litigation?
Right. And when he was the deputy chief litigation counsel, and he and I overlapped for, I'm going to say, about a year, and then when he left to go to Merrill Lynch, I took over his job.
Okay. So it sounds like the cases going out of Santa Fe were a pretty heavy workload.
They were.
So is it fair to say that insider trading was a focus of the Enforcement Division?
It was, yes. Insider trading was a focus. An additional focus, which was also important, were transactions occurring through overseas anonymous accounts, principally Switzerland, but also other jurisdictions.
The two of those being related, I would
say. They were related, or they could be related, for sure. They weren't necessarily, but they were related, and they became more related as history went on. There had been an earlier case, which I was not involved in, which was handled by the New York office of the SEC in terms of the work, involving training through a company called Banca della Svizzera International, where a freeze order had been entered and where the court had ordered the bank to disclose the identity of its customers in response to a subpoena, which made the problem a government-to-government problem between the United States on the one hand and Switzerland on the other. And then that same issue arose in the Santa Fe case. And so one of the focuses of the ensuing 2 years was how was a system to be developed by which the government of Switzerland would feel comfortable providing information to the government of the United States and nevertheless maintain its legal regime. And that took a couple of years to work through. So that was a big part of what was going on in those cases.
I would think that this would have been, that sort of work would have been done on a very high level. I know John Fetters was particularly involved.
Well, Fetters was involved in it very much. I mean, that was, you know, among his major contributions, I think, to the agency. Michael Mann was very involved, and he was sort of the staff lawyer in these two cases, and he became interested in this very bright guy and sort of really developed knowledge and expertise in the area. I was involved as well. The other thing that Michael and I developed was a strategy in the... What we wanted to do was to develop outside of the Swiss legal framework as much information as we could about who the likely purchasers were.
This is in the Santa Fe case.
In the Santa Fe case, in order to make as compelling a case as possible that something illegal had happened. For two reasons. One is, and we did that for two reasons. One is we didn't want the court case simply to languish, because we were concerned that if it appeared to the court that no effort was being undertaken, that maybe we wouldn't get anywhere. Two, we wanted to make as compelling a case of culpability as possible, because the way we appeared to be headed was that the Swiss would insist on a standard of dual criminality, i.e. that what had happened would have been a violation in Switzerland of Swiss law as well as the United States law, and therefore it was not a violation of Swiss law to disclose this information. So that took a lot of work, and Michael had the imaginative idea of taking discovery in England through letters rogatory, which was because there were some English witnesses, which was also a different way to proceed. So there's a lot, it was an interesting and sort of trying to be innovative effort.
I've heard the insider trading initiative at this point described as a program. And of course,
well,
Shad had his big quote about hobnail boots.
Right.
Would you characterize things this way?
The enforcement division likes to call everything a program, and I don't know why. It has been, since I can remember.
How coherent was this push?
Well, it was coherent in certain respects and not coherent. And I don't know. It was coherent in the sense that the cases were identified as ones that the agency was interested in pursuing and investigating, and so that was communicated both internally within the staff and I think externally to the community, which was beneficial because that meant that people who thought that there were violations would be more likely to report them than otherwise. It wasn't the case that that's what was communicated. I don't know whether that makes it quote coherent or not, but that's what happened. And so people were encouraged to work on these cases, and it was something that was considered interesting and desirable to do.
And was a lot of this push from the top? Was it coming from the changes that came in with Shad, or was insider trading an area of focus that people on your level and below were interested in?
I think both. And the way, reason I say both is that, I mean, yes, Shad was concerned about it, so was Fetters. The other thing that was occurring was that this was a period of very significant merger and acquisition activity. There was a lot of perception in the marketplace that insider trading was occurring in significant levels. That was eroding confidence in the marketplace. It was also, some people say that insider trading is a victimless crime, so to speak, but there were some victims in the options markets. People who were obligated to make markets had to sell contracts, and then they would then have to pay on those contracts, and they were sort of stuck essentially subsidizing people. So it was not victimless.
So how did the Santa Fe case work out? Did you take that
well,
to the conclusion?
Well, we did. I mean, ultimately, the way it worked out was that at the end, in the end, the government did provide the names of the traders pursuant to mutual assistance agreement in criminal matters. And once that transpired, the case settled. Now, this is the New York case. There were a couple other cases. There was one in Seattle. There was one in San Francisco, for sure. There might even have been a fourth one. I can't remember.
Were you also involved in the Thayer case?
I personally was not, except on the side. The Thayer case was really handled on an investigative basis by Carmen Lawrence and... there's another lawyer whose name is escaping me. He'll come back to me, who was very much involved in that. Philip Parker. And then Alexia was the trial lawyer in that case.
You said on the side. Would that just be the informal sitting around?
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, I was down the hall. I'd hear about it, but I was not working on it.
How much of that took place?
A lot.
I guess I'd like to get a sense of what the culture was like in these early years.
I don't know that it's any different now, but and it's not different than my experience in other, at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think, one of the advantages of government service compared to, let's say, my experience in the private sector since is it's very collegial. There's much more, first of all, people are more likely to be working on similar matters than in a law firm. While people worry about time, you're not marking your time. You're not selling your services on a per hour basis, and so people have more opportunity to talk to each other about what their common interests are, professional interests are, their common issues. There's also, because people are working towards a common goal through the agency, more of a sense of common mission. So that tends to promote, a high degree of collegiality, which is pleasurable, like, being in a faculty or some other
right.
circumstance.
And the sense of common mission. I would think that it must change over time in a place like this.
I'm sure it does.
What was the focus in the early 80s? What were the priorities, or what sorts of things did you and the colleagues share as part of that presentation?
I don't know that it was that profound, but the priorities were, at the time, the issue, the cases tended to be focused. Insider trading was certainly a significant one. There were a lot of market manipulation cases at the time in the penny stock and other markets. This was the era. There were a number of a lot of cases involving, one of a better term, various get-rich-quick schemes, gold for tax dollars type stuff. There were some accounting and financial reporting cases, but not as many. And although that was already becoming an increasing focus, I mean, that was something that was of concern both to Fetters and to Shad. One of the things that Fetters did was, before John, the way the division had been structured is the accountants were all sort of assigned to different groups of lawyers on a one-on-one basis. John centralized that and I think appointed the first chief enforcement accountant and brought in a very high-energy partner from KPMG, what was then Pete Marwick Mitchell, now KPMG, to be the first chief enforcement accountant.
Who was that?
Glenn Perry. And that was very significant, I think, because Glenn came from a background of auditing big companies, had a sense for what was right and what was wrong in terms of accounting, and it created sort of a high visibility, high profile role for the accountants within the division that continued and indeed has expanded.
And these were the things the lawyers would have missed.
Of course they would.
And at this point, did you get promoted to associate director?
I did in 1984, yeah.
84. How did your job change at that point?
Well, a lot, because I didn't have time to do litigation, although I did keep my hand in it a little bit, probably more than I should have. Changed more to a focus on supervising a large number of investigations.
And you've got a bunch of teams that you're watching.
Right.
How much of their focus was insider trading?
Well, it turned out to be a lot, although that's a label that's applied. It turned out to be a lot, but that was by happenstance as opposed to design. Because the reason I say that is that in 1985, we got assigned to what became the Dennis Levine insider trading case, that was partly because. At the time, it was not a matter that people were rushing to work on.
Why not?
Well, because it seemed to be, it appeared to be a road that would lead nowhere. Notwithstanding the Santa Fe and the Bank of Dallas Fitzgerald cases, there were other cases that were extant regarding trading through overseas banks that weren't going anywhere. Very difficult to figure out. So there were a number of them where people were spending a lot of time and effort trying to figure out what had happened and who the traders were without getting anywhere. And so this had the appearance of being just another one of those.
And these other overseas bank cases you're talking about, did all of them just sort of fade away?
The one I'm thinking of did. Yeah, I mean, I don't think any case was ever brought from it. Although there was a lot of work.
was the there was another notable case in there. Became the Carpenter case.
Right.
The journalist Foster one.
Right.
Was that in your
office? I did not work on that one. No. That was Lynch's case. And I'm not remembering who the staff lawyers were on it. I know, again, that was another case that Alexia Morrison took to court.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the legal underpinnings
right.
to what you were doing. There were, my understanding is there are essentially two kinds. You could really have two kinds of insider trading cases. One growing out of the more traditional 16B, which is deal with real insiders.
Not really. 10%. Not really. I mean, the issue, I mean, you're right. I mean, that was in terms of U.S. securities law, the dominant issue at the time. And the question had to do with the with in order for there to be a violation of for insider trading violation, there has to be a purchase or sale of a security by a person while in possession of material non-public information, and then there has to be in breach of a duty of trust or confidence. And that initially arose out of a case called Chiarella in the Supreme Court. Chiarella was a printer, and there were a lot of cases like this. Chiarella was a printer at a in New York who would print up offering material for tender offers. He would take the information and then buy or sell stock using it. The Supreme Court held that he could not be liable in the absence of proof that he had breached a duty, which they defined in terms of a fiduciary duty. And the question then became, well, what's a fiduciary duty? Now, there was a lot of pessimism about could you make a claim as to a person who had no duty of loyalty to the shareholders
right.
of the company whose stock one was buying or selling, which created a conundrum.
And this was pessimism within the community?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, I think Chiarella was a significant loss. Which created a conundrum, because if I was hypothetically the investment banker for not for the company being acquired, but the company making the offer, in theory I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't owe these shareholders anything. The misappropriation doctrine was a response to that, and was initially developed, and frankly, I'll have to look it up. I can't remember the name of the case. There was a criminal case in New York in which the theory was initially developed, and the theory arose out of the application, not of insider trading law, but of the mail fraud statute. And the theory was that, which ultimately was accepted by the Supreme Court in the O'Hagan case,
right.
you know, more than a decade and a half later, or maybe a decade later, was that if the information was being used in breach of a duty of trust or confidence, that was sufficient, even if it was not a breach of duty of trust or confidence with the person who was on the other side of the transaction.
So you were working under this misappropriation doctrine,
which was not yet widely accepted. I mean, there was a district court opinion that was affirmed by the Second Circuit. There was then a case wending through the courts that the Supreme Court ultimately decided in 1983 called Dirks, which dealt with a different issue, TIPI liability, and which was also a loss for the commission. but which contained a footnote, footnote 14, that suggested various different kinds of duties that could be implicated in insider trading law. And so the one of the issues that was being developed in parallel to the overseas secrecy cases were a number of cases not dissimilar in terms of their facts to that which was in Chiarella. Cases involving insider trading rings where the source of the information was the office manager for a major law firm. Printers again. And then that, you know, again came to the fore in Carpenter because the information as to Carpenter was different in kind. It didn't have anything to do with the actual fundamentals of a particular corporation. It had to do with what was the Wall Street Journal going to write tomorrow. And so Carpenter was prosecuted on the theory that the fraud was on the journal. It was the theft of its intellectual property, fundamentally, and then the exploitation of that, the injury to the journal being that if its intellectual property was stolen and misused, that would cast doubt on its credibility as a publication, its integrity, which in turn was what it was really selling in the long run.
As you watched these cases unfold, and changes, things happening in the district court that were, you know, sort of putting things into question or suggesting new actions,
right,
how were you adapting your enforcement approach and instructing those teams to maybe take, do something.
Well, I mean, the things that we would focus on more were, you know, people would start to focus on proving up what was the duty, what was the nature of the relationship between the people who had information, how they conveyed it, what instructions were given with the information as to use or misuse. That became a major focus of what people were doing. The other thing that was taking place on an investigative basis was that given the prevalence of insider trading rings, is what I'll call them, and people who were in a position to acquire information on a variety of there's sort of two different kinds of insider trading cases. There's the one-off, you know, corporations being taken over, somebody on the board hears, you know, knows of it, tells their friend at the golf club, that person says, ooh, hot tip, I'm going to do something with this. And then there were the cases involving people who were really in the financial services industry, whether directly for broker-dealers or for service providers, who would regularly misuse information. And those became a focus on an investigative basis. People would look for patterns. And so that was a big part initially of the Dennis Levine case, was trying to figure out what's the pattern. Because once you knew the pattern, then you could better find out who the trader was, even if the trading was coming through an overseas account. Or conversely, in other cases, the source.
Even though you've got these cases that you're looking at, there's no definition of insider trading. You can't say, you know, at any given time, here's what we, if we prove this, we're good, right?
There wasn't as clear a definition as one might like. I mean, the two issues that were always in play were. Where it was one, the issue of duty, and the second issue was what is the level of knowledge or use? Meaning, is it enough merely to know the information, or must the information have been used for a particular purpose? That typically was a lesser issue.
Duty being the first one.
Duty being the first one. Right, that is the fiduciary duty issue. Yeah, it's the same thing.
And the level of knowledge or use getting more to the fraud.
Yeah, it, you know, it was more, did the dog eat the homework or not? You know, yes, I knew this, but I thought it was a great company, and it didn't the information didn't matter. You know, it's sort of very one specific. But there was a split in the courts about whether the standard the commission had to prove was possession, knowledge, versus use, i.e., something that motivated the transaction, which is still an issue, but it's been more clarified. The commission's issued rules on that subject, or it amended 10b-5 in the insider trading area in the 1990s to essentially create a rebuttable presumption that if you possess it, you used it.
Okay. So before that, there's the issue of scienter.
Right, which is the same thing, yeah. But that's a case, an issue in every fraud case.
You got the Insider Trading Sanctions Act.
Right.
In 84.
Correct.
Or so.
Right.
Where did the push for that come from, and how did that change the way you did your work?
Well, the push for it again came from Shad and Fetters. It was valuable in that it, one of the problems that the government had been facing prior to the act was that from a financial point of view, insider trading carried little risk, in that the liability was limited to a repayment of profits plus prejudgment interest. So if you were trying to do a risk reward, as much risk. The Insider Trading Sanctions Act created significantly greater risk from a financial point of view. Now, in truth, I don't, you know, I've never been of the view that that's the real deterrent. The real deterrent is people being afraid to go to jail. So what made the effort on insider trading successful, ultimately, was not just that, but the active cooperation of the Justice Department.
Did the RICO statutes have anything to do with that?
No. No, not it didn't. First of all, those are very difficult to charge and prove. They were rarely used in the securities law area, sometimes, but rarely. More fundamentally was the fact that people really were, you know, that was a level of risk that most people who, at least in the insider trading ring type cases where you've got something that's not, is a true scheme rather than a thoughtless act. That's the kind of sanction that people think about.
And that had been, you as long as you got the Justice Department involved, you could, you know, throw people in jail before the insider trading sanctions.
Yeah, and subsequently, but equally importantly, I mean, one of the problems in any kind of white collar case, this isn't just true insider trading; it's true elsewhere. In terms of development of a case, although it's more true in insider trading than say accounting cases, is that. It's much more true now that I think about it, is that the ability to prove a case directly is very limited absent the cooperation of an insider. And in the incentive to become, in effect, a state's witness, is not high. You know, you're going to be a pariah. You're going to be a snitch. You're going to be a fink, whatever you want. You will be admitting one's own culpability. And so why do that, right? Well, if the reason to do that is stay out of jail, that's a strong reason to do it. That made a huge difference in the ability to investigate and ultimately resolve these cases.
How many instances like that did you have before the bank case started?
Well, there were certainly some. There was a major insider trading case that's before my time at the agency called involving some bankers at, I think, Lehman and another bank called the Courtois case, which is actually written up in a book by Jim Stewart called The Prosecutors. There was a parallel criminal investigation in connection with the Santa Fe International case, which was ultimately did not result in any criminal prosecutions, but which was of great benefit in terms of one, establishing dual criminality, and two, keeping the momentum up in the case. So that was a big benefit. I don't remember. Obviously, there was a criminal case in Thayer. I don't remember the others. I mean, I'm sure there were.
But you weren't spending lots and lots of time talking, sort of deposing people who had turned, so to speak.
No. No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about getting to that big instance when you did.
Yeah.
How did the Bank Lou case come to you?
Well, it was really pretty much by accident. Somehow or another, there was an anonymous letter sent to Merrill Lynch. They did an internal investigation. Reported that to, I believe, to Gary Lynch. And then Gary assigned the matter to me.
So Gary Lynch is running enforcement at this point?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the transition like from Fetters to him? I mean, obvious, putting aside some of the unpleasantries.
Right.
Did he bring a different approach to enforcement?
In terms of substance, I would say no. In terms of style, I'd say somewhat yes. But it really is just a function of personality. The transition, unfortunately, was abrupt. And it was accompanied, not surprisingly, by a period of uncertainty because Gary was initially appointed as the acting director. It was not immediately apparent whether he would remain as the director or not. At the time, Gary and I are the same age. We were then the two senior people at the ripe old age of 33 and 34. So it wouldn't, it wouldn't have been surprising if, in hindsight, if somebody, Gary had gray hair prematurely, but it wouldn't have been surprising if somebody with more gray hair showed up on our doorstep. So there was some uncertainty there. Certainly, though, by 6 months to a year, that was done.
Was there uncertainty as to what the focus of enforcement would be, as to whether insider trading?
I don't think so. I don't really think so because, Gary had been at the agency his whole career, pretty much. He'd been doing what he was doing for a couple of years. I know Fetters thought very highly of him. So did Chairman Shad. We weren't getting a new chairman. And it's really, at the end of the day, the chairman who sets the agenda. The commissioners weren't turning over. It was, a reasonably consistent group.
Before we sidetracked off into the transition, we were talking about what became
right.
the case. Can you just give me a sense of how that developed within your office, how you figured out who to staff it, what your role was?
Well, my role was, certainly through the point where we got to bringing a lawsuit, or close to bringing the point of bringing a lawsuit, largely supervisory. The matter was the lawyer who was working on it day to day was Peter Sonnenthal. He had a financial analyst working with him, and I regret that I don't remember his name. And also, regrettably, he died some years ago.
Ed.
Yeah. No, that's not the name, but Ed is the right first name. And one of the problems with the initially, getting one, there were two problems. One is that initially the bank wasn't providing any information and was asserting we didn't have jurisdiction over it. The second problem was that what we were initially following was not just the bank's trading, but trading by a group of people in their own accounts, which were a group of Merrill Lynch brokers and friends and relatives.
Are these the ones in Caracas?
There was the Caracas group, and then there were others. It wasn't just them. There was not, unlike the situations of which, say, Chiarella was an example, but there were others, you couldn't just say, well, this information has to have come from X bank or Y law firm, because there was no there was no single link between and among all of the transactions. So that was one problem. The other problem was that initially the bank was not cooperating and asserting that we didn't have jurisdiction over the bank. Ed Harrington is the name of the analyst. Peter and his supervisor, Leo Wang, found out, they may have found it out from the bank, they may have otherwise, and I think the bank was attempting to cooperate, so to speak, to the extent it felt it could without violating bank secrecy law, or lawyers thought it could. Found out who was managing the account of the bank. Because eventually they learned that the bank was involved, the bank was trading in parallel, because that would have come through U.S. brokerage firm records. And they ultimately found out the name of the person who was managing the account was a fellow named Bruno Pletcher. I think it was Leo's supervisor was a lawyer named Paul Fisher. And it was Paul's idea to enlist the assistance of the Customs Service to do what was called a border watch. So a border watch was put out for Bruno Pletcher, meaning that if he came into the country, the Customs Service was supposed to give us a call that he was around. I gather one problem with working in the Bahamas is that it's not a whole lot to do if you're living there as opposed to being a visitor. And so eventually, Pletcher showed up in New York, and Harrington, a subpoena was ginned up, and Harrington went to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, found out the room he was in, and knocked on his door and served a subpoena on him, which had the value of establishing clearly um, the commission's ability to obtain jurisdiction over the bank to get the records, because they had served an employee of the bank in the United States, which sort of brought, which is where the two issues of what's insider trading and international accounts comes full circle, because that brought this issue back into the Bankas, Fitzgerald, Santa Fe cases, albeit with a different country, but also involving a Swiss bank.
Right, Bank Lou was a Swiss bank.
It was a Swiss bank, but this particular unit was a Bahamian bank. And so that then made the ability of the bank to resist the subpoenas much more difficult, and put the bank in a different circumstance. And I think, prompted the bank's lawyers, Harvey Pitt, and Bob Rausch, to review the matter very differently. And what I know about what they did really is what I read in the books, as opposed to what they've told me. They're pretty discreet guys, but evidently that led them to get a different story of what was happening out of the bank. So, what followed is that the bank worked out an agreement with the commission, pursuant to which there was parallel paths. One is that the bank would provide information to the commission short of the identity of the customer. The commission would undertake a number of measures which would either seek to persuade the government of the Bahamas to permit the bank to disclose the identity of its customer, or to put the bank in a position where it had a defense of necessity if it had to disclose the name anyway. So there were two efforts. One is that a subpoena enforcement action was brought under seal, ordering the bank to disclose the name. And secondly, essentially a mission was sent to the Bahamas to persuade the Attorney General of the Bahamas that this was the right thing to do. And so Lynch went to the Bahamas with Michael Mann. They convinced the Attorney General that this was that the Bahamian statute covered only banking transactions. This was not a banking transaction, therefore there's no problem. And he initially agreed. The Bahamas later changed his mind, but he initially agreed.
But it was too late by the time they changed their mind.
But by the time they changed their mind, it was too late. So then using that information, the Dennis Levine case was developed, although we'd had a pretty good idea before that that Dennis Levine was the guy.
Really?
Yeah. Again, based on just, good investigative work by people who were working in my group. Going back through the matters, one of the companies whose stock was traded was a company called Textron. And Leo Wang remembered the Textron case, remembered taking Levine's testimony, because he was a banker involved, and being suspicious of the guy. And based on that and another piece of information I'd rather not talk about, we pretty well thought it was Dennis Levine. So once the bank's cooperation was obtained, then information and testimony was obtained from the bank. We also basically shut the case down otherwise. We weren't looking for information anywhere else, the idea being not to in any way alert Levine or others with Levine that the government was even close. And the Justice Department was working in parallel. And so, going back to your question about cooperation, what transpired was that the day that the lawsuit was filed, Levine was arrested. what ultimately led him to become a government witness, you know, one would have to ask him. But at the time, A, all his assets were tied up. He was subject to a preliminary injunction. He was fired, and he was, going to be arraigned. So there was a powerful incentive on his part to try to work things out, which he did.
So, did you really coin the phrase Moby Dick?
I think so. Yeah.
So by the time you did that, you had a sense that Levine was probably.
I think that was a little later, but it was around the same time. Yeah.
Okay. Were you ever concerned about establishing the grounds on which this thing could be successfully prosecuted? It seems as if once you got into the Bahamas and once you got the name.
Not really. There was some mild concern about the legal theory, and I remember there was litigation initially in the Levine case. We got a temporary restraining order. We moved for a preliminary injunction. Levine resisted the preliminary injunction.
What was the preliminary injunction to do?
It was to enjoin him from violations of the securities laws, but more importantly, to maintain the freeze order on his assets.
Okay.
We had a good draw too. We had the judge presiding over the case was Judge Owen in New York, who was a very good judge. And Levine's lawyer, Arthur Lyman, among other things that they argued was that, you know, there wasn't a breach of, wasn't, you know, the insider trading laws were a mess. But the advantage we had is, you know, there was 25 different deals. And the facts were pretty, you know, as which we developed and worked damn hard to do, were pretty colorful. Somewhere in those 35, there had to be at least one where there was a classic insider trading violation. So, that Levine was the banker not for the target, but was the banker for the target as opposed to the buyer. So that didn't really, you know, there was a lot of anxiety would we prevail. Anxiety over the legal theory was not what I was worried about. But I do recall there was, as part of the argument in the preliminary injunction, there was a discussion about the misappropriation theory and the effect of Chiarella. And I remember arguing to Judge Owen, because I did the argument myself, that one should not make too much of the Chiarella decision. It did not attempt to define insider trading. It was simply a holding that the jury instruction was wrong, that the district judge had made a mistake. And somebody later told me I should have been a little bit more careful because it was Judge Owen who issued that jury instruction in the Chiarella case. He didn't say anything about it. He was pretty polite, and he did rule our way. But it did come across like, you know, that's just that dodo district judge blew it, you know. Judge, don't worry about that. You won't make the same mistake.
At this point, was this case, and I guess it pretty soon it's rolling out into the Boesky case and everything after that. Did this pretty much take up everything you were doing at this point?
No. I mean, we had lots of other cases going on. But in terms of my own time, it was certainly 50% plus. I mean, certainly, you know, at the end of the day, it was my view that, you know, the other stuff was important, but in terms of what was going to, you know, get the SEC either going or in hot water, as the case may be, this was the one.
Yeah. were there any other developments on the insider trading front at this time?
From a legal point of view, yes. I mean, there were. I mean, bear in mind that the question of whether misappropriation was an accepted legal theory was never, you know, it was accepted in the Second Circuit, which was key. There was a subsequent case called Musella, M-U-S-E-L-L-A, that went to the Second Circuit, also a printer case, where the Second Circuit accepted the misappropriation doctrine. The Carpenter case went to trial. The Second Circuit affirmed. The Supreme Court then affirmed on mail fraud
in the Carpenter case,
but split 4-4 on securities fraud, meaning that the Second Circuit's view on misappropriation as an element of securities fraud was still good law, but, you know, also clearly indicating that there were four people who didn't think so on the Supreme Court in that context. So there were cases in other circuits dealing with the same issue. And over time, most of them were going the same way. There was one in the Ninth Circuit, for example, which was a case of mine that was tried and then went to this. I think there was one in the Seventh Circuit, which was a case of mine.
When you say a case of yours,
meaning folks, my supervision worked it up, and I remember being involved in it.
How much involvement did you have with the regional offices?
More on a consultative basis than any direct basis. I mean, they didn't report to me, and at that time, the regional offices did not report to the director of enforcement. That happened. Chairman Leavitt decided to do that.
Would they have been involved in bringing and working on some of these insider?
In many instances, certainly the New York office was,
yeah,
very much. Other offices were to a lesser degree, but typically it was to a lesser degree.
And would your people go in and help?
Again, on a consultative basis, but not typically on an active basis.
Well, you were talking about the legal development.
Right.
And how the misappropriation
right.
was working its way
right.
to the district courts.
So, you know, that was continuing, and ultimately there was a split because the Fourth Circuit took a contrary view. And another, as did another circuit. I'm not remembering which one it was. That's essentially what led all of this to get resolved by the Supreme Court in the O'Hagan case.
So you were working. Your teams were working on the Boesky case. Were you still there when Milken?
Yeah, well, I mean, that one quickly elided from one to the other,
yeah,
because Boesky, in the timeline was essentially the Levine case broke in May of 1986. Boy, time flies. Levine case was resolved in June of 86. Shortly thereafter, other people who were, for want of a better term, part of the Levine ring also were resolved. Most notably, a fellow named Robert Wilkes. That led, the principal lead out of Levine was to Boesky. Working up issues on Boesky and then sending a subpoena to Boesky for documents occurred. The workup was June, July. The subpoena went out, I think, early August. Late August, shortly before Labor Day, was when Boesky made the decision to cooperate with the government, or initiated discussions with a view to doing that. Those were completed mid-September. So mid-September to November 14 was a period of developing Boesky's information and working with Boesky.
In which he's out there trading.
Right.
Doing that, and you're involved in developing the case here, I guess.
Yeah, very. I mean, that was, you know, it was pretty, because also all of this was, you know, which was very unusual for the SEC, extremely hush-hush. You know, there were only a handful of people who were aware of what was going, knew what was going on. All the meetings with the commissioners were closed. And by closed, I don't mean normal closed. Closed, you know, meant anybody could wander in out of the commission meeting room, but these were, you know, before you show up, you got to be authorized to come in. Attendance was very limited. You know,
well, a big question would be the decision to, you know, let people go out there on his
right
for a couple of months. It would seem from your point of view that that would be a great thing to do.
Well, from an investigator's point of view, yes. It was... there was also a, there was two concerns. One was, does one maximize the investigative value of Boesky's cooperation? And this was something the U.S. Attorney's Office was very anxious to do. They were really, really, really wanted to do it this way. And so they were the people who were really pushing for it. It was helpful to us, because it sort of gave us a quiet period to talk to the guy and figure out what he was what he knew before the media circus began.
But was there a sense in the SEC that, well, this is not as usual for us?
Absolutely, yes. And I think, you know, a number of the commissioners, Shad in particular, was very concerned. I mean, Shad was, you know, people worried about, well, you know, it was certainly unusual. Yeah, I mean, people worked, you know, because, you know, inherent in this process was putting a fair amount of trust in somebody who admitted widespread violations of law,
right.
And who had custody and control over billions of dollars.
Did you ever actually sit down and talk to Boesky?
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
He was an interesting person. One of the things that one learns is, you know, I've sort of learned since I've left the government, is that when you're a government investigator talking to somebody, it's a stilted conversation. Because it's just not a normal interaction. People, the government, you know, they have enormous power to hurt people. There is a guardedness or an unctuousness, sometimes both. But Boesky struck me as a person who, notwithstanding his public persona, actually had quite a bit of insight into himself, and I mean, in a psychological sense.
Which maybe could explain the cooperation that he provided.
I think so. Yeah, I think he had a sense that this was sort of an unreal world he was in, and an artificial construct.
Was Now, at this point, are you starting to think about stepping down from the commission?
Oh, no. I didn't leave for another 4 years.
Okay. We're talking about 87, 88?
This was 86.
Oh, 86. Okay. All right. And then you went into the Milken case.
And others.
Okay.
I mean, there was the Milken case. There was the Siegel case. There was, now, at that point, there was another line of cases initially dealing with the Jeffries firm and Boyd Jeffries.
These grew out of the Levine case?
Well, out of Boesky, yeah.
Yeah.
And Bill McLucas handled those, and they in turn led to another group of cases, which were ongoing. So
by the late 80s, you must have felt like the insider trading cases were never going to stop coming.
The only issue, I think, was when would the statute of limitations, how many could you get before the statute of limitations ran out, really, to be frank with you. And now, the other part of it, too, was that, you know, the Drexel case was fiercely resisted. You know, the context here, you know, the context of it when seized today where, you know, the government calls up Corporation X. Corporation X goes out to hire a law firm to do a self-investigation, turns over everything it knows to the government because of its fear that it will be indicted and go out of business. That's a sea change. That thought process did not exist at the time. And Milken was the franchise at his firm, which was a big outfit. So they resisted fiercely. It was not, you know, the interaction between the government and a corporation at the time was just completely different. You know, the effect of the Enron environment on how corporations react is just a sea change.
Why didn't something like what happened to Drexel help create that?
I don't know. My guess is that twofold. I mean, one is that the ripple effects of the Drexel demise were not the same as the effects of the collapse of Arthur Andersen. You know, financial transactions are just much easier to move from place to place than the relationships between an auditing firm and a client. They're a lot more embedded. Secondly, if you go back to, you know, what I said before, which was that Milken, for all intents and purposes, was the franchise, that was a different perception than what happened to, or at least to Arthur Andersen, where what you had happen was an auditor, and to be sure, Enron was a big audit engagement client, but as a percentage of Arthur Andersen's revenues, I'm sure it was less than 1%. And they would have gone on just fine without Enron as a client, had before, they would in the future. And so the notion that, you know, the entire firm would be destroyed because of the conduct with regard to an audit partner in connection with a client was just real different.
Yeah. How is the... I talked a little bit about the culture of enforcement, what things were like.
Yeah.
Maybe I was pushing for something more profound than there was. But did you see a change in the place you were working from the early 80s to the late 80s?
Yes.
What was that?
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, When I got there, I think that the commission was still only relatively small and, frankly, relatively powerless agency, which the cases of the 80s and the efforts in the 80s, did a couple things. One is that I think they began to focus public attention on enforcement of the securities laws and made it much more of a national focus and priority. There was congressional legislation in 84, 87, 1990. The budget of the commission doubled in that period of time. It became much more of a focus. Secondly, it made, for young lawyers, particularly young accountants, it made it a very exciting place to be. It increased the commission's, I think, general visibility. I remember, going to the airport about 85, 86 or so, buying a ticket to go get the shuttle to New York, and I had a SEC credit card. And I presented it to the person at Eastern Airlines, which was then ran the shuttle, and they said, "Oh, you're one of those guys." And that wouldn't have happened 2-3 years before.
One of those guys being good?
Yeah, in a positive way.
You and some of your colleagues were written up almost like, little rock stars.
Yeah, I mean, and that probably, obviously it was fun, but in addition, when what you're doing becomes the subject of two Pulitzer Prize winning books, one of which is a bestseller, they're both about legal issues, so they're going to be read by all the law students. That makes a huge difference in terms of the desirability of a place to be to work. And I think the commission became, competitive as a place to work with private employment in terms of, and B, certainly within the government, competitive with all of the United States Attorney's offices, which I think for purposes of this kind of work, was sort of the place to be.
So there's a very noted effect then on the commission itself.
I think so.
Working enforcement.
I think so.
How about the impact of these famous cases on the law itself?
Well, I think clearly it had an effect on the law. We sort of walked through that. I think it also had an effect on business culture. Certainly in terms of my perception and working with clients sort of in the immediate aftermath, the consciousness about insider trading and concerns about it within industrial corporations and safeguards clearly improved. The other thing is that I think it also very much changed the culture and mores of practice within Wall Street about the uses of information, the need for client confidentiality, adhering to that, the importance of assuring the firm's reputation is not tarnished by what employees may be doing. Obviously, history subsequently shows that the Wall Street firms continue to have their issues, but that's probably inevitable. But I do think it did two things. One is it increased consciousness in this area. Secondly, it began an increase in the consciousness and power of the compliance function within those firms. And so I think net-net, in terms of having an impact beyond the particular matters, I think it did. That was socially beneficial.
Your decision to move on.
Yeah.
had you sort of felt like you'd worked through everything that you were going to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I had been there 8 years, and what I was beginning to see in the late 90s was that I was going through a cycle of sort of doing the same thing over again, which was fine, but, you know, necessarily when one is doing something the second time around, it's not always as exciting, and so I decided to try something new.
And you could argue that odds were that you weren't going to end up with anything...
Almost assuredly, you know, I mean, the events were a once-in-a-lifetime thing, so...
Is there anything that we haven't discussed that we should talk about before we break up?
You know, one can talk infinitely, so not that I can think of. I appreciate your taking the time. I hope this was helpful.
And thank you.
You want to elaborate on it, I need clarification, let me know.
Okay.
Okay.